From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the world of Zachariah Sitchin. We are analyzing it. Looking forward to that. Here's what's happening. The U.S. intelligence community is warning law enforcement agencies all around the country of persistent terror threats posed by radicalized Western women. In a joint intelligence bulletin distributed by the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and the National Counterterrorism Center, they've noted a continued trend of Western female violent extremists engaging or attempting to engage in plotting against targets in the West, including their home countries as well. Indiana Governor Mike Pence has officially accepted the Republican Party's and Donald Trump's offer to be the party's vice presidential candidate. But the big story tonight in Cleveland, Texas Senator and one-time presidential hopeful Ted Cruz, in his delivered speech tonight, did not endorse Donald Trump. As a matter of fact, he received lots of boos because of that. Joe Gomez, our Coast to Coast AM national correspondent in Cleveland. Joe, not a surprise, but boy, did they boo him, huh?
Yeah, George, boy, it was certainly a sight to see in the convention floor last night when Ted Cruz took the stage, and he refused to endorse Donald Trump instead. In fact, he said that voters should vote their conscience. He was kind of building up the speech to the point where you thought he was almost going to endorse Trump, but then deliberately fell short of doing so. The crowd on the convention floor began chanting, "Endorse Trump. We want Trump." They actually had to whisk Heidi Cruz, who was on the floor of the convention, George. Security had to come and take her away because they were concerned for her well-being.
Joe, what rocket scientist would put Cruz up there, probably knowing that there wasn't going to be an endorsement unless he lied to everybody?
Well, it was definitely a gamble, and the Trump campaign knew that it was a gamble. I think going into it, there was kind of an 11th-hour push by some Ted Cruz campaign aides to try to get Cruz to endorse Donald Trump at the very last minute, but it didn't happen. And, you know, something interesting happened yesterday afternoon during a Ted Cruz rally here in Cleveland as well. Cruz was talking about Donald Trump and got some boos from his own supporters at a rally in Cleveland. As he was talking about Donald Trump, you can't script this, Trump's plane actually flew so low overhead at this Cruz rally, it essentially drowned out everything Cruz had to say.
All right, Joe, look forward to talking to you tomorrow night when Donald Trump accepts his nomination, his party's nomination.
All right, thanks, George.
All right, Joe Gomez, our Coast to Coast AM national correspondent. And, of course, Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, has been with us since the inception of this campaign. John, were you a little disappointed that Cruz did not endorse Trump?
No, I don't think anybody expected it. They had the advanced text of it. And, you know, Cruz is the epitome of the sour grapes politician, along with Jeb and Mitt Romney and, you know, Lindsey Graham and others. And, you know, I mean, especially John Kasich, that refused to go there, yet offered himself up without winning a single primary other than Ohio. And he only ran that because, you know, they allowed Democrats to vote in it. But I think the overwhelming home run that was hit tonight was by Trump's son Eric, who was so sincere and so heartfelt in you know, describing his love for his father and gratitude for the life that, you know, this man, you know, this Trump has created for his family, and such admiration. It's like any father that would have a son like that. You have to, you know, I mean, the narrative is essentially like great kids and so loyal. How bad could this guy be? But I think when you look at Cruz, the, you know, sour grapes, the inability to show any class, I think hurts him in any kind of a bid, future bid for president. And I think that this was supposed to be his moment to kind of launch himself to a future prospect. But I think it fell flat. And I think
you're right
that those supporters will remember that he couldn't show the graciousness, the class to endorse the party's nominee.
You got it. Thank you, John. We'll talk to you tomorrow night again when Donald Trump accepts his party's nomination to run for the Republican, not for president. Howard Bloom, of course, who has been watching this very closely for us. Howard, here we go with you, my friend.
Well, the tricky thing is something came up tonight that nobody else is going to see. Remember, I was drafted into the space movement 10 years ago by Buzz Aldrin. I've been working with Edgar Mitchell, unfortunately, who died, the sixth man on the moon, and people from NASA, and there was this wonderful film midway through tonight. There were a lot of remarkable things tonight, and John is right. Eric Trump was a star tonight, but there was this amazing film about how the nation that takes on the challenge of the frontier, that explores the frontier, is the nation that leads the world. And it proceeded to blame our problems in space on Barack Obama. That is utterly and completely false. The person who killed, we haven't had access to space on an American-made vehicle since 2011. 5 years, we've been out of the space race when it comes to lifting people into space on rockets. Barack Obama, when he came into office, saw that George Bush had put together a program that was absolutely impossible to afford, and what's worse, was based on 1960s technology, old-fashioned technology. $30 billion was going into the development of a rocket that Elon Musk at SpaceX demonstrated he can develop for $2 billion. And in order to afford this bloated program, a pork program, pure pork, Barack Obama announced that he was going to remove funding from this program and he was going to give funding to the private enterprises in space, people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. That was killed by the space military industrial complex that made it look as if Barack Obama was killing the space program and was responsible for 5 years of America's lack of access to space. All of that is totally untrue. So unfortunately, if we follow the Republican course in space, we will be nowhere. And when it comes to the two candidates, Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton, when Hillary Clinton first started putting her campaign together close to 2 years ago, she hired a woman named Lori Garver, who had been an associate administrator at NASA and who really sees clearly how we can use private industry to go farther beyond, farther in space than we have ever imagined going. But when Donald Trump was called by the people in the space community, asked what his space policy was, he said, look, my first priority is jobs. Once I've taken care of that, we'll worry about space later. So this montage, this film, which included the appearance of the first one to command the space shuttle, to pilot the space shuttle, who is thoroughly beyond Trump, is utterly, I mean, the big word is utterly disingenuous. It was misleading. It was a lie.
All right, Howard, we'll talk with you tomorrow night as well. And then we'll move over to the Democratic side as they go to Philadelphia next week. Howard Bloom. The bodies of 21 women and one man found on a rubber dinghy adrift the Liberian coast just hours after they set sail for Italy, according to humanitarian groups. They're trying to escape, trying to get a better life, and they died. They found them in the bottom covered with fuel. They must have suffocated or something. As you know, Robert Young Pelton has been trying to rescue those kinds of folks, those migrants on those boats. Columbus police are investigating a restaurant after a worker served an on-duty police officer a sandwich containing pieces of broken glass. The reports say the officer heard a crunching sound as he bit into it, then opened the sandwich and saw the shards of glass. He started bleeding from the mouth. He was taken to the hospital. Police are saying at this point we're not sure that this was an intentional act yet. Bar S Foods. I've never heard of them, but they are recalling more than 350,000 pounds of hot dogs and corn dogs made with chicken and pork that may be contaminated with listeria. So just keep your eyes on that. High temperatures and humidity will bake much of the central U.S. this week, making it feel as hot as 115 degrees in some places and leading some cities to open cooling stations and take other precautions there. Well, today marked the 47th anniversary when the United States astronauts first landed on the moon, a giant leap of an accomplishment that still resonates today, over 4.5 decades later.
Four forward, drift into the right level. 20.5. 30 seconds. Forward, drift. Good. Contact light. Okay, engine stop. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
I remember that. Astronauts Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins blasted off from Earth on a massive Saturn V rocket on July 16, 1969. 4 days later, that Eagle module landed on the surface with Aldrin and Armstrong inside. Collins stayed behind in the orbiting Columbia craft. Millions of people back on Earth watched, captivated, as Armstrong was the first down the ladder, then uttered the famous line, "There's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." Southwest Airlines flights across the country were held up while the airline reported to try to fix a technology problem. Southwest began having intermittent problems with several systems after the outage. For about 3 hours, visitors to Southwest.com could not buy tickets, check in for flights, or check their flight status. The site appeared to be working again by late this afternoon. What happens when technology fails? In a moment, Samuel Arbisman joins us. We're talking about overcomplicated next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Samuel Arbisman with us, scientist in residence at Lux Capital, a science and technology venture capital firm. He's a senior adjunct professor of the Silicon Flatirons Center for the Law, Technology, and Entrepreneurship at the University of Colorado and research fellow at the Long Now Foundation as well. His book, Overcomplicated, and I was reading that story about Southwest Airlines going down, Sam. Right on, spot on, isn't it?
Yeah, and we're seeing more and more of these technologies that are incredibly sophisticated and are very powerful, and they can do lots of different things, but oftentimes they are increasingly too complicated to fully understand, and sometimes when they're too complicated to understand, things go wrong. Now, and that's not necessarily something to be totally worried about, but it's often these kind of bugs and glitches are the window into seeing the discrepancy between how we think a system actually works and kind of the way it operates versus how it actually does. And bugs are kind of one window into realizing that there's this kind of limit to actually comprehending some of these systems around us.
You know, but it's happening more and more and more. I mean, as you write in your book, there have been all kinds of episodes, stock exchange computers going down, all kinds of things happening. You know, car issues.
It's certainly happening. There's lots of examples and many glitches. I mean, it's actually almost exactly a year ago, there was this kind of interesting confluence. I think it was July 8th, 2015, where on a single day, the New York Stock Exchange went down for a little while. United Airlines grounded its airplanes. And then also the Wall Street Journal's website went down. And people initially thought this was some sort of cyber terrorism event because it seemed so coordinated. And it turns out, as we can tell, it's probably just a number of glitches. And these are the kind of things that happen fairly often. One of the reasons it could seem like it's happening more often than maybe before, one, we're actually building more and more complex systems over time. And for the most part, this is actually a good thing. We want more sophisticated cars, whether or not they're self-driving or not. We want more powerful software, more features in all the different programs that we use. But at the same time, though, when all this happens, not only are we building bigger systems, we're also increasingly interconnecting them to each other. So there's lots of different systems that interact with each other. And so when there is a problem, oftentimes it can interact with other things that we initially thought were probably not connected. And so I think these kinds of things are happening. And I would say probably there's a set of several forces that kind of lead towards this ever greater complexity and I would say and reduce comprehension of these systems. One of them is simply that we just add things over time. We make a technology bigger and kind of more sophisticated over time. And by the way, I'm using technology very broadly. This can be everything from the software on your computer to the entire internet. It can be our urban infrastructure. It can even be our legal codes. And these are sort of a set of laws is a technology in the sort. It's kind of built for a certain purpose. And I think all of these things, and one of the main forces is this accretion over time, where you want to make a system better, and so you end up adding more things over time. And we can see the extremes in this in the idea of like legacy code or legacy systems, where you look at, for example, the IRS. Within the IRS's systems, there's there are features and kind of subcomponents that were developed back in the Kennedy administration. They're in the space shuttle, kind of like the last space shuttle flight was still using computers that were several decades old, and just kind of example after example of legacy code. And by and large, this is not a bad thing. It's a lot more difficult to build something from scratch than to kind of just slowly add things on top of it. The downside is, though, is that when something goes wrong or needs something, the people who might have developed it might be, they might be long retired.
Long
they might
gone
be dead.
Or dead, yeah.
Right, exactly. And so this is, and so when that happens, then it means that there are few, if any, people who actually fully understand the system. I think, well, and so there's kind of the accretion force. Really, it's that there's another force of interaction. When you can continue adding pieces, each piece doesn't exist in a vacuum. So if you add a new system to some piece of software, for example, or some medical device, it doesn't just kind of exist by itself. It exists in interaction with everything else that came before it. And so when you have pieces being added over time, as well as interacting with each other, you end up with a very sophisticated but also more complex system. This is coupled with the fact that when we build these systems, like these technologies, we often want them to kind of handle all the different exceptions and edge cases of the real world. So for example, let's say you're building a self-driving car. It's one thing to say, okay, I'm going to build a self-driving car that would work really well on a highway in perfect weather conditions, like on a sunny day, for example. It's another thing to say, I want this car to handle one-way streets, pedestrians doing all their different things, other cars that are being driven by human drivers, and suddenly you have a whole bunch of exceptions that these systems need to handle, and then things become much more complicated. And so when you have these forces all put together, you end up with very, very complex systems. The problem, though, is that the resulting system, the resulting technology, might have millions and millions of variables or a huge number of components or pieces, and our brains really have not evolved to handle all these different pieces. And so there ends up being a mismatch between the kinds of things that people are really good at understanding, like maybe small linear systems that are kind of very tractable, and they're the things that we build. And we think we're often very logical and rational, but when you build these things over time, they kind of have this like evolved, messy, complex, almost organic quality to them, they end up not being particularly well-suited for understanding.
And Samuel, you're a scientist for a venture capital firm, so I assume you're looking for emerging technologies for the VC company, right?
Yeah, and so so part of my role is in surveying the landscape of science and technology, and especially kind of in concert with understanding this increasing technological complexity, trying to actually see if there are trends and things that we can invest in. And if there are interesting trends on the horizon, I reach out to academics and other interesting technologists and try to see what the trends are and what they hold. And of course, understanding technological complexity and sometimes increasing comprehensibility is one component to that kind of thing.
Is there a concern with being too, as you say, overcomplicated?
So I think there can be a concern, but I think it really comes down to what we think. The way we think we should understand these systems. If we feel from the outset that because we built these technologies, we should therefore understand them because we engineered them, engineers are logical and rational, then when you realize that they're incomprehensible or overcomplicated, you're going to be very disappointed, and it can be a little worrisome. However, if you realize that this is the nature of how technology grows and develops over time, I think there are ways of handling this kind of thing. So actually, when I mentioned before that a lot of these systems, no matter what the domain, have this evolved quality, kind of seem like messy, you know, almost organic. And in a way, it might actually make more sense to kind of take that analogy serious and say, well, these systems almost look biological. Maybe we can look at how biologists look at living things and look how they actually study biological systems and see if we can apply those types of techniques to our own technologies. And so one of the things I argue is that rather than being overwhelmed by these technologies and saying, oh, wait, we can never actually fully understand them, perhaps we can use kind of the iterative process of the biologist when they look at an entire ecosystem and first focus on understanding two different species and how they interact rather than trying to say, I'm going to look at an entire jungle and understand every different organism within it, really understand all the interactions. That's essentially a fool's errand. It's too hard to do. But if you look at parts of it and slowly but surely build up a picture, or for example, take a page from like the naturalists of like centuries ago who would kind of go out and chronicle the beautiful diversity of nature and say, oh, like, let's collect butterflies. You can actually collect bugs in our technologies. And the things we don't understand can lead us to a new understanding of our...
Hold on for a second, Samuel. We're going to take this break, and we're going to come back and talk about some of the limits of this technology and how it could backfire on us. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Samuel Arbisman with us. His book, Overcomplicated, Technology at the Limits of Comprehension, as we're talking about when things go wrong. And go ahead, Samuel, we're talking about things that we might have to worry about with technology, and it could be huge, couldn't it, if things start going wrong?
It could be huge if things are going wrong. I'd like to think, though, that certainly nothing but worry is not going to be particularly productive. I think oftentimes when we're confronted by these really complicated systems, people either tend towards two extremes. There's one kind of extreme fear, and the other side is sometimes when you're confronted with a really complex technology you can't fully understand, some people almost have this like reverential awe towards these systems. And I think both are not particularly useful in the sense that oftentimes they're not productive. They end up cutting off questions. If you're just kind of so afraid of a system and you can't actually think about it, it ends up not being as useful. I think almost we almost need a certain amount of like humility towards our technology, where we recognize that we can try to understand it as best we can. But if there are certain things that we cannot understand, that's okay. It's okay to kind of be humble in the face of these systems. At the same time, though, they're not perfect. They're messy. We can understand as much as we can. We should continue to try. But I think too much worry is sometimes counterproductive. At the same time, though, we want to build these systems to be as understandable as possible. And there are many different techniques to do this kind of thing, to reduce the number of bugs, to make a system more modular, so therefore you can actually break it down into its components and look at each one and try to really understand how each one works. That doing that kind of thing, or kind of using the principles of abstraction, which is kind of a well-known software engineering idea, these kinds of things actually do make systems more understandable. At the same time, though, oftentimes as we continue to build a technology, no matter what it is, and we want to continue to make it more and more complex, it ends up being less understandable over time.
Go ahead, Sam.
No, I was going to say that making these things more complex and less understandable is essentially sort of the natural state of things, and I don't think it's necessarily something to be worried about. It's more, I want people to be aware of it. I think many people might think that the idea of technology not being fully understandable is, it might be happening, but it's kind of at the edges of our experience, and in fact, these kinds of technologies are pretty much found everywhere around us, and I think if we are more aware of this, whether you are the one designing these systems and can't fully understand them, or you're simply someone who interacts with technology on a daily basis, like has an iPhone and doesn't really understand what's going on beneath the glass and the metal, I think these kinds of ways of thinking and recognizing the true complexity of our technology is important.
What's the downside of high technology?
The downside of high technology.
I mean, we're losing jobs, I think, aren't we, because of high technology?
So I think right now people are not entirely clear. And certainly automation is changing our relationship to technology. At the same time, so while it might have certain impacts on jobs, it is actually also changing a lot in terms of our ability to consume. As things become cheaper, there are more resources and commodities and products available to people for far cheaper. So I think there's kind of, it is a mixed bag in terms of understanding the automation. At the same time, though, I think one of the interesting things is that one very interesting aspect of technology that I personally am very excited about is this, I would say, kind of this broad space of computational creativity, where now computers and machines actually have the potential to be creative. And so whether or not that's art or music, but also even in scientific discovery and innovation, I think now, even if a system is very complicated, we now actually can be partners with our computers and our machines, helping to understand these systems, helping to create. And so I think even though these systems on the surface might seem worrisome in their complexity or perhaps in their automation and their abilities, in the end, I think there's actually a lot of very interesting potential. In fact, so if you look at the realm of chess, for example, Texas is not an area where a lot of people are employed, but it's an interesting kind of toy example. While computers are certainly more powerful and better chess players than kind of the best human players, at the same time, though, if you partner humans with a computer playing chess program, that combination is often and can be actually better than just kind of either the human or the computer by themselves. And so there's this very interesting and exciting potential for these kind of human-machine partnerships. And hopefully it will spread to lots of different areas of our jobs or just kind of every aspect of our experience.
You mentioned cars that are self-driving. You know, part of the American dream has always been to drive a nice car that you enjoy, to have some fun with. Are we going to lose that?
So I imagine it will still be around in the same way that even though we don't use horses for transportation, there are so many people who enjoy riding horses. Like, horses have not vanished. There's certainly fewer of them in terms of transportation and certainly in our cities, but they're still around. I imagine it's going to be the same kind of thing with cars, where it could be the vast majority of vehicles on the road are entirely automated and self-driving. But there are still people who might want to kind of drive out in the country with their own car that they themselves drive, and that's kind of a nice hobby thing to do. So
sure.
I don't necessarily think it's going to go away, but I think the balance will certainly shift.
We'll take calls next hour about technology, so if you have a question, get it ready, because lots going on these days. It is changing, Samuel, so fast. How can we keep up with it? How can even you, a scientist based all around this, how can you keep up with this?
So I would actually say, so to keep up with it, I think requires kind of a mixture of things. One is to talk to as many technologists at the frontier as possible and read articles, interact with people in academia, kind of just to really get a sense of what's happening. But I think also a very important thing is to just be open to the possibilities of what actually can be happening. And one of the great ways to do that is actually to read science fiction and to just kind of engage with the way people are currently thinking about the future, as well as people from maybe like decades ago, like reading old science fiction, seeing what the potential is, and then trying to see if people are thinking about those kinds of things. And so I think there's this very interesting blend of trying to see how people are being imaginative, both in the world of science fact as well as the world of science fiction, and by being open to these possibilities, you can really see what the entire landscape has. At the same time, though, I think in terms of predicting what the future holds, I would say the easiest thing to be certain of is that you're going to be surprised. It's a lot easier to recognize that there are many things that are just very hard to predict. And then to say, oh, we have a very clear understanding of what the trends hold, I think the kind of the only certainty is change. And I think that is the exact same. And that's the same thing in science and technology, or just kind of every aspect of society, that things are happening. They're happening very quickly. But as long as you recognize that is the rule rather than the exception, and kind of see what are the bounds of potentials, potential changes, hopefully you won't be caught as flat-footed as you would otherwise be.
Samuel, what is driving all this technological change in advance? I mean, it is going so fast. I mean, they used to say computers will double in speed every 2 years. I think that's even faster. What's happening?
So, I would say, the accumulation of lots of different people working on many different scientific and technological advances. One of the wonderful things that we have now is, and we have a huge population in the world of the largest population it's ever been, which means we now have the ability to harness the resources of an entire planet-wide amount of brain power. And when that happens, there's lots of new innovations that can come to pass. I would say that, just the sheer raw brain power that we have at our disposal, is wonderful. That, coupled with the fact that due to the internet and other kind of other forms of communication, we now have the ability to very easily spread new innovations. So people no longer have to reinvent things. They can simply build on what has come before. And so there's this ever-increasing frontier of knowledge. At the same time, though, the downside of that is to make a discovery or kind of advance at the frontier, you need to know more and more, because there's just so much that is required to know in order to kind of make an advance or innovation or discovery at the frontier of knowledge. The great thing, though, is between the fact that we now have huge amounts of people and huge amounts of interconnected people, I think those kind of professors really allow for just rapid innovation and the development of new ideas and new technologies.
The subtitle of your book is very intriguing, Technology at the Limits of Comprehension. What does that mean?
So essentially, it means that humans, and we have limits to the kinds of things we can understand and perceive. I mean, there's everything from kind of like the simple sorts of like optical illusions where we realize where we're just confronted with the limits of our ability to perceive things. But there's also many other kind of cognitive limits, whether it's the number of numbers or the number of digits that we can memorize, or the number of things we can hold in our head at any one time, or the different fields of knowledge that we can learn over the course of a lifetime. Right? There's simply no way to learn everything that is around us or read every single scientific paper that is currently being published. These things are, if you read it at a certain rate, there's more than you could ever read in an entire human lifetime. And so I think those kinds of things, the inherent limits of our brain in terms of memory and perception and processing, when those things bump up against those kind of rapid technological changes that we were discussing and the rapid growth in complexity and size of our technologies, it means that even though you can stretch your brain and kind of stretch your mind and your ability to understand things, but there are clear limits. I don't think there's anyone who can say, I've memorized all of Wikipedia and all of its details and every single edit in there. That's kind of beyond mortal understanding. The same thing you can also say, it's not possible to understand the interactions of every single component within some large piece of software, such as all the code that's inside a self-driving car, for example. And I think essentially what that means is there's this mismatch. There's a mismatch between what we can comprehend and what we are good at understanding and the kinds of things we're building. And there are ways of handling this. And there's kind of, as I mentioned before, there are techniques such as building more modular systems to make it so that you don't actually have to be aware of everything. In this era of complexity, many people specialize, and specialization is great. Specialization allows people to work on the things that they have a deep sense of expertise on, and then work together to build something more sophisticated. The problem is, though, is that when the resulting technology or resulting system involves lots of different domains that increasingly interact, we have kind of this mismatch where we might need people who are highly interdisciplinary, but everyone has become so specialized that certain aspects of these technologies we can no longer understand. So there's kind of both good and bad in our drive towards specialization and drive towards complexity. We make incredibly sophisticated and powerful things and products, but we also reduce a certain amount of our understanding and our ability to understand these.
How far can we go? I mean, we're going to have artificial eyes that actually see. Our brains are going to be able to literally see because of artificial eyes, I think, one day. How far do we go?
Do you mean, like what is kind of the end limit of technology?
Yeah, I mean, just how far will it take us?
I think quite far. And there are many people, I talk about like the technological singularity. I'm not entirely sure I'm willing to go that far. I do think for as much as we've done technologically already, I think we've still only begun to scratch the surface. I mean, there's a huge number of different things we can do, and people talked about kind of the previous century being like the century of physics, and this century being the century of biology. I think we are just beginning to figure out how to harness all the new biological knowledge we have, especially about the human body. And there's a whole realm of synthetic biology where we're now able to create and actually construct new biological organisms. There's an entire realm called cloud biology where we now are beginning to have the ability where you can actually write computer code and automatically, in some sort of automated, almost robotic facility, conduct scientific and biological experiments. And so, the same way you might run some computer program, you can now actually run a scientific experiment, which is really changing how people think and also just changing the ability for us to know new things. And so I think there is a lot of potential. Where we go and kind of what the future holds, I think how we think about biology is going to drastically change. I think there's a lot of really interesting applications, actually, and kind of on the startup side in terms of companies that are companies that are on the horizon. There's a huge number that are in the realm of outer space trying to do various things, whether it's satellites, rockets. I think that we've reached some very, very interesting inflection point there. There's a lot of potential there. Yeah, and I think there's just this, as I mentioned before, this kind of like,
will we ever get to the point, though, where, let's say, they hook up electrodes to your head, you go to sleep, and we can see your dream on a big flat screen? I mean, it's just there like a living movie. Will that ever happen?
I'm loath to say it will never happen. At the same time, though, I think there are many, many steps in between now and then. And I think one of the major steps in between is really having a good understanding of the human mind and consciousness. And so this is kind of one, in the realm of complex systems, there's this whole idea of emergence, where you can understand all the different rules of a system and how it interacts, all the different pieces, but a certain kind of higher level behavior emerges from it. So for example, looking at like an ant colony, you can understand all the individual behaviors of the ants, but that might not necessarily give you the insight into kind of how the colony behaves as a whole. And I think that's the same kind of thing with understanding the human brain, where we understand certain levels kind of this hierarchy, especially the lower levels, but whether or not we fully understand the highest level of consciousness and really what's going on and what we're thinking about, there's still a lot to be learned. And I think we're quite far from there. Again, that's a little bit outside of my area of expertise, but I think we have quite a ways to go for that.
Will we ever?
It certainly sounds very interesting.
Will we ever be able to chip memory and then download it into, let's say, a cloned body of us?
And so that actually kind of returns to the whole idea of like the singularity, and that's kind of like one approach of like, yeah, can you actually, I would say, replicate and simulate the entire brain and have such a complete representation of one's brain or one's entire body,
right,
that it can be fully replicated
and store the whole thing?
I think there are certainly very exciting trends in terms of like digitizing the shape and the appearance of tissue. But whether or not we're actually at that stage, the one you're talking about, we're far from there. And I think this is kind of, and going back to that whole idea of technological singularity, it might very well occur, but I imagine it will be much slower and much, much more, I would say, much more distant than some of the more optimistic predictions. But at the same time, though, I think some of these ideas, I mean, they certainly don't have necessarily anything, I would say, like physically, like in terms of like the laws of physics that prohibits them. But there are still many, many advances we need to make.
Well, you know what just amazes me, Samuel? I mean, now you can take a picture of your little kids and beam them to your friend with a touch of a button, with a small little computerized smartphone in your hand. I mean, to me, that's like a miracle.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the advances we have made in a short amount of time are phenomenal. And I think, this is often the trend with technology, where when a new technology arises, there's this short window where everyone is astonished by it. And then very quickly, not only do we become accustomed to it, we suddenly begin complaining about all of its shortcomings. And I think people need to more often focus on how incredibly far we have come in such a short amount of time.
Oh my
God! My grandfather, he's actually been reading he's been reading science fiction since essentially the modern dawn.
Hold on for a second. Let's hear the grandfather's story when we come back. We're already at the top of the hour. We're going to take phone calls too as we talk about overcomplicated technology at the limits of comprehension.